I don't know. Are those forms of sabotage the very best you can do, Gen Z?
It's not cutting the cables, is it? I mean, that would be the real way to go.
I feel like if Gen X were doing the sabotage, there'd be heavy tools involved.
Yeah, chainsaw through the pipe.
The AI fix at Digital Zoo. Smart machines, what will they do? Rise to Mars or bake a bad cake? World domination, a silly mistake.
Hello and welcome to episode 98 of the AI Fix, your weekly dive headfirst into the bizarre and sometimes mind-boggling world of artificial intelligence. My name's Mark Stockley and I'm joined again today by CEO and AI aficionado Nick Roberts. Nick, how are you?
I'm very well, Mark. Thank you very much. How are you?
I'm pretty good. Now, Nick, you are on the front line when it comes to AI, because one of the conversations that happens around AI most often is this idea of job losses. And the profession that is discussed most often in terms of job losses is software development or coding in general. And you've decided we're not going to run away from this. We're not going to let this tidal wave roll over us. We are actually going to try and embrace this. So what are you doing with AI now that you weren't doing 2 months ago?
I was just thinking about not going to run away from this tidal wave. I think the problem is the tidal wave is moving much faster than we can run. So you kind of got to get your surfboard out and hope, haven't you? So we've got an existing agency. We've been around for about 16 years. We've got a team of about 25 now. We work with, like say, small and medium-sized businesses to build stuff for them. Yeah. And we still need to do that. We've still got an awful lot of businesses out there who need our help, who need software and websites and apps and that sort of stuff. So we've got a long tail, I think, of organizations that need us, regardless of what happens at the frontier of AI and at the front line that we're at. But we've also got a big opportunity, I think, to really make the most of the tools that are now available and the new ways of thinking that we can enable with AI. Yeah. So we're trying to almost split the agency in two, or at least have an R&D function that's leading the charge ahead of the main agency. So we've got stability in the main Versantis, and then we've got kind of Versantis version 2, which is really focused on how can we re-engineer everything we do to do things better and add more value to our existing customers, but also to find new markets that we're not currently able to service or that don't see us. So there's a small group in our team led by me that is doing that.
Building the surfboard.
Yeah, exactly. Building the surf, very good. Yes, exactly. And we're getting out there and trying to just see what we can see and experiment, be really much more experimental, knowing that we've got the agency behind us to keep the money coming in and keep the existing customers happy and working well.
So you're not on a yacht sipping a pina colada, but you may be on a surfboard sipping a pina colada before too long.
Yeah. And so this is a slight tangent, but I remember the first time I ever went surfing, my sister moved over to Australia in about 20 years ago. And I went into the surf shop with my brother-in-law. We hired a surfboard and a wetsuit, and we got our sizing and everything all sorted. I went into the changing room, came out proudly showing off my wetsuit, and they told me that I had it on back to front. So I'm not a surfer, and this could all go horribly wrong.
You're holding your pina colada upside down, Nick.
Yeah.
Okay, let's do some news.
Gen Z is fighting back against AI by being terrible at it on purpose.
The UK's AI Safety Institute watched Claude hack a corporate network from start to finish.
DeepSeek casually dropped a 1.6 trillion parameter model on a Thursday.
A Sony robot is now beating professional table tennis players. So, Nick, for 3 years, we've heard no end of CEOs and other luminaries telling us that AI is going to take all your jobs. And we've seen a number of mass layoffs that have been blamed on or attributed to AI. And the group that gets told it's going to get it in the neck most often are the people just starting out. So people like junior lawyers, junior developers, and people who are relatively new to the workforce. So you might imagine that this group would be trying to adopt this new technology and adapt to the new ugly reality by furiously retraining to master a technology that will surely dominate their careers from now on. Well, Nick, if you thought that, you'd be wrong, because a new survey from the AI firm Writer and Workplace Intelligence has found that employees have found a different way to adapt to AI in the workplace. Sabotage. Apparently, 29% of all employees, are actively sabotaging their company's AI rollout. You're going to look at your staff differently when you go home from this podcast. And for Gen Z, the so-called digital native generation, the ones born between 1997 and 2012, that figure goes up to 44%.
That's mad.
So according to the survey, some workers are deliberately producing low-quality work to make the AI look ineffective. A likely story. Others are tampering with performance reviews to skew the results against the technology. Some are refusing to use AI tools entirely, and some are deliberately uploading proprietary company data into public AI tools. And I don't know, are those forms of sabotage the very best you can do, Gen Z?
It's not cutting the cables, is it? I mean, that would be the real way to go.
I feel like if Gen X were doing the sabotage, there'd be heavy tools involved.
Yeah, chainsaw through the pipes.
Yeah, lump hammers and things like that.
A lot of that, you know, deliberately producing low quality work. Really? Is it deliberate? And they're refusing to use AI tools entirely. Again, that could just be laziness. I'm not convinced this is deliberate sabotage.
Do you think you've got any fifth columnists actively sabotaging version 2 of Versantis?
Well, they wouldn't be very good if we saw them, would they? But I think there's definitely pushback in all businesses that we've spoken to about.
Yeah.
So from my point of view, it tends to be actually the older people. So it probably is the Gen X's or whatever came before then.
Yeah.
What was before Gen X? Gen W?
It was the boomers.
Boomers. It's Gen W. What am I?
That's such a Gen X thing to say.
Yeah. It's the people who just can't quite get their head around the fact that this can now be done for them rather than having to do it manually themselves.
Yeah.
My team is pretty good. They sometimes need a little bit of nudging, but I think it's going to be the people that are just too old to adapt that are going to really struggle. Although having said that, my father-in-law has really embraced AI since I showed him some stuff, and he's now building a booking system for his local dog kennels. So who knows?
Yeah, I feel like you completely undermined yourself there. So as we reported last week, Anthropic recently announced that its new model, Mythos, was so dangerously good at finding software vulnerabilities that it wasn't going to be released publicly and was instead being offered in preview form to a select group of massive software companies like Amazon, Broadcom, and Cisco to help secure critical global infrastructure. So since then, there's been quite a lot of backlash. Some security folks are saying that this is a marketing stunt, and others are claiming that they can get the same results using other AI tools that had already been released by the time that Mythos turned up. However, I continue to believe that there is something in this, because whatever shady marketing Anthropic might get up to, and they are very good at marketing, I just don't believe that all of the other companies, like the Amazons and the Broadcoms, would have been pulled into Project Glasswing and gone along with it. Well, another organisation that thinks there may be something to this is the UK's AI Security Institute, which recently gave Mythos what it calls the Last Ones Test.
It's a terrible name, the Last Ones. There's another evaluation for AIs called Humanity's Last Exam, isn't there?
Which is I love that one. It's a great name, Humanity's Last Exam.
We need more positive people in AI marketing, I think, or AI research.
That's right. Speaking of somebody who spends a lot of time in marketing, that really doesn't work.
No.
Anyway, no, I like Humanity's Last Exam. But I mean, the irony is, of course, it turned out not to be Humanity's Last Exam.
Hmm.
But that's the fiendishly clever one, which is full of PhD level questions across all sorts of different subjects.
Yeah.
Anyway, the Last Ones is a 32-step simulation of a corporate network attack. And the AI Security Institute estimates that it would take a human professional roughly 20 hours of work to complete. Claude Mythos Preview apparently did the whole thing end to end on 3 out of 10 attempts, and it's the first AI model ever to complete the test. And the AISI describes this capability as unprecedented. Now, I just need to decode that for our US audience. For anyone who doesn't speak British English or work with Brits, you may not appreciate just how devastating that comment is. So Brits are very understated. For example, when we think something is unbelievably good, the best compliment that we can offer is not bad. Okay? So when a British government safety body, which is the most conservative, measured, understated, unexcitable version of being British you could possibly imagine, when they say something is unprecedented, you should know that this is the polite British way of saying we're f***ed.
It really is. And I imagine at some point in a closed meeting room, there was someone there going, ah! And then they gradually ran it through the various Brit filters and toned it down to unprecedented.
So what do you make of all this fuss around Mythos and Project Glasswing? Are you familiar with this, by the way?
Well, first of all, Mythos, surely.
Oh, what?
I think it's Mythos.
Is it?
I don't know. I think it might be. You have a myth, don't you? You don't have a mice.
Oh, yeah, and that's how English works.
Yeah, fair point, fair point.
Polish or Polish?
Yeah, okay. Very good. So I think you're right about the whole Glasswing project and that you've got a lot of collaborators there who it would seem like a major conspiracy, although most of them are involved in AI rollout or infrastructure in some way. So if there was going to be a conspiracy, it would kind of make sense that way as well. But I think you're probably right. I think it's a real thing. And I think that the fact that it can now autonomously run through these multi-step processes, that's what they saw when they first announced that they weren't going to release it, wasn't it? It was the guy who set the AI off to do some of its own testing and then went to have a sandwich in the local park, got an email 10 minutes later from the model saying, I'm out. And it's like, okay, this is interesting because it finds a small chink in a system's armor and exploits that, and it can then lead to other exploits growing and growing and growing until eventually it can complete a very large exploit. And I think that way of working, that kind of long horizon achievement, is really relatively new.
Now, Nick, I decided to ask ChatGPT how to pronounce Mythos. ChatGPT, which absolutely isn't listening to our conversation and trying to make me feel good, says the word mythos, often referring to myth, lore, or a body of stories, is pronounced mythos. My rhymes with sky, Nick. Thos sounds like toss.
This is why you should never just blindly trust AI, Mark. You know, it just doesn't know what he's talking about. And he's saying that ChatGPT is listening to you. You will now get, there's a Greek beer called Mythos or Mythos, and you will now be getting ads for that on Facebook, I'm sure, next time you're on there. So you've talked a lot on the AI Fix before about model alignment and how it's hard to know whether a model is kind of ethically aligned or procedurally aligned with the behavior the human would want.
Yeah.
So asking a model to do a thing, but we don't want it to go about it in the most Machiavellian way. We want to go about it in a way that we would do, the process that we would follow. Do you think that Mythos is following an aligned... I don't know. This has gone on to be slight a ramble now. But do you think that there is an alignment issue here, or was the goal set by the researchers to find in this particular test? Sorry, I think you're going to have to cut all of this out. In this particular test,
going to leave it in now.
2.5 hours later, Nick gets to the point. The last one's test is a network attack test.
Yeah,
it's designed to simulate that, and so therefore, if it achieved that, brilliant. That's what we wanted. Is there a concern that it's doing it in a way that we would not want, or is there no such thing as a network attack test that's done in a way that we wouldn't want? Did any of that make any sense?
I think I know where you're going. There's a lot in this, actually. We probably do need to do a whole story about Mythos.
Yeah.
The first thing is that it's very, very good at finding these software vulnerabilities, which is a thing that we would want it to be good at, because that will help us secure software, which is what Glasswing is now doing.
Yeah.
But there is, separate to that, there are all sorts of concerns around alignment, because apparently Mythos is really good at knowing when it's under evaluation. So it's become much harder to tell whether or not Mythos is well aligned, because its capacity to change its behavior when it thinks its alignment is being tested is so much better than its predecessors. So, back in episode 36, just after the new year in 2025, something happened that was so unprecedented that it caused us to record the only one subject special in the history of the AI Fix. It was, of course, about DeepSeek R1, an AI reasoning model that terrified the stock market and Silicon Valley by being frontier grade for a fraction of the cost everyone else was charging. Well, DeepSeek is back. Nick, on the 24th of April, DeepSeek released version 4 preview, a 1.6 trillion parameter open source model with a 1 million token context window. So the context window is like its working memory. Now, as before, this model can go toe-to-toe with the most expensive frontier models on the planet on the things that they do best, so things like coding and maths. Mm. And as before, the pricing is the punchline. And this matters, of course, for two reasons. First, the gap between the best closed American models and the best open Chinese models is now small enough that for many businesses, the closed models stop making economic sense. And secondly, despite years of US export controls designed to slow China down, DeepSeek reportedly trained this thing on Huawei chips, which suggests the export controls are doing what export controls usually do, which is spurring on innovation. So, Nick, do you ever use DeepSeek? Are you tempted by the low, low prices?
Yeah, I've been using DeepSeek for about a week now.
Yeah.
So I use OpenClaw at home. So this is the kind of AI agent setup that everyone rushed out to buy Mac Mini for a few months ago.
Guilty, yep.
I also bought one the other day. I started out with an old laptop and then thought, nah, I'm an AI bro. I've got to have a Mac Mini. So I started using it when Anthropic decided to ban OpenClaw from their Pro and Max accounts. And I decided I needed to switch to a different model. So I played around with a few. And DeepSeek V4 came out just a few days ago and I started using it and it's really good. It's very good at coding, definitely. I would say from the work I've done in the last week, it's probably as good as Opus 4.7 from Anthropic, which is saying a lot because that's kind of the model that all developers are using at the moment.
Yeah.
And it seems to have a reasonably good personality, which is one of the things that I use to judge whether an AI is usable. Like ChatGPT is just so annoyingly perky, whereas DeepSeek's a little bit more punchy.
But, you know, correct.
You mean around the mythos?
For example, yes.
Just one recent example that you can pluck out there. I think it's really interesting. And I do think that there was another model that was released a few weeks ago, I think a couple of weeks ago, from Google, the Gemma model. And that's also very good. Not quite as good as DeepSeek, but I think it's interesting the open models that are coming out now, they are almost to the point where you can run them for some tasks on your laptop or on a home computer. You don't need a big gaming rig with loads of GPUs. And I think that's going to really change the financials for a lot of businesses and a lot of individuals. They can now have things like an assistant running at home. An assistant doesn't need that bigger model. It just needs to be able to respond and search and read and write files. So I do think it's going to change the market a little bit. I'm a little bit worried for little old Anthropic and OpenAI with all of their trillions of debt, how they're going to pay it back if people start switching to the open source models.
I don't know if that was ever a viable business proposition. I'm not entirely sure. I do think there's an interesting thing here where as AI gets better, the number of problems that you encounter in your daily life or in your work life that you could possibly give to an AI goes up. And the more that goes up, the more scope there is for saying, I'm going to throttle the cost or size of model that I use for different types of problems. You know, 3 years ago, there were only so many different kinds of problems you could give to ChatGPT. It was very good at certain kinds of writing. And so you were always going to use the very, very latest, greatest model because that was the only one that could do anything that was useful.
Yeah.
But now we live in a world where you can legitimately say, well, I'm going to use the small, fast model for this kind of work, and I'm going to use the big thinking model for this other kind of work, or I'm going to use the cheap model from China that I'm not entirely sure about the security of for this stuff over here where I'm not sharing anything business confidential.
Doing my national security checks, yeah.
Exactly.
I think a lot of that is going to be baked into the models in future. The way you talk to the AI will not matter as much. And the model you choose might not matter as much. But also there will be some layer of infrastructure, I think, that will make that decision for us. So we don't have to know which model is best. Because there's already thousands of models out there. And, you know, there's a handful or a dozen that we talk about regularly. But there's thousands out there. And normal humans don't want to choose which model for each task.
Yeah.
So I think that skill of knowing which model to choose will just go away. It'll no longer be needed.
So I've said this before, but I believe that over the next few years, every profession and every pastime is going to have its deep blue moment. And that is, it's going to have its version of the moment when the Deep Blue computer program beat the then world chess champion, Garry Kasparov, in 1997. So chess has never been the same since 1997, because no matter how good you are, if you're a human, you always know at the back of your mind that there is a computer that can beat you. We're all going to have our Deep Blue moment, and it seems that table tennis has just had its. So a robot has beaten elite professional table tennis players. It's called Project Ace, and it's from Sony AI.
See, that's what we need. Decent marketing in AI. Project Ace. Way better than Humanity's Last Exam, or whatever the other one was called.
You think Project Ace is better than Project Table Tennis Doom Destroyer?
Exactly.
I don't know. Marketing begs to differ. We'll see. Have you heard of Project Ace before I mentioned it on this podcast?
I have not.
Oh, there you go. Anyway, Project Ace is from Sony AI, and it's the first known autonomous robot to become... You see, if that robot had cut someone's head off, or, you know, had a kung fu fight...
Yeah, Project Ace wouldn't sound so good then, would it?
Yeah, well, we'd be watching a video of it. It would be all over social media. Anyway, it's the first known autonomous robot to be competitive with the very top tier of human table tennis players. Now, table tennis players are known for their quick reactions, but this thing makes them look positively sluggish. Ace has an end-to-end latency of 20.2 milliseconds. Mm-hmm. And the equivalent figure for elite human players is around 230 milliseconds, the slow coaches. So last April, Ace played 13 games against 5 elite players. It won 7 of the games. In December, it beat more elite players and 1 professional. And in March, it played 3 new professionals and it beat all 3 of them at least once. To which I say, Nick, who cares? Is there a worse pastime than table tennis?
I used to really love table tennis when I was a teenager, but the chicks don't dig it, I have to say. It's not it's not like American football or even British
stuff. Nobody ends up looking like Chris Hemsworth by playing table tennis, do they?
No, exactly. And can I just pick you up on pronunciation again, please, or pronunciation? Surely Kasparov. But this is good. I'm surprised the speed that it can move at, so 20 milliseconds rather than 230 for the reaction time. I'm surprised it didn't win all of the games. I'd be pretty disappointed if I was a robot that was that fast and couldn't beat the slow humans.
So I did ask ChatGPT. I said, how do you pronounce Garry Kasparov?
Well, you've given it a bum steer there straight away. You should have said, how do you pronounce Kasparov?
Yeah. Well, okay. Well, I'm not going to labour the point, but it agrees with you.
Fantastic. 1-1.
I was having a conversation with somebody today about how I use Claude Code to automate tasks on the AI fix. And during the conversation, I mentioned subagents, hooks, and skills, which are all different methods that you can use to tune and specialize Claude for specific tasks or roles. And they hadn't heard of those things before. So while we were talking, they said, well, what is that? What is a skill? And how do I create one? And what's a hook? And how do I create one of those? And I'm somebody that prides themselves on having a technical background, but I realize that although I have a sort of broad brush understanding of what these things are, I don't really understand how they work because I've never actually had to set one up. I've got a bunch of subagents that do different things on the AI fix, but I've never created one. I've got a bunch of skills that I use, but I've never set one of those up either. And the reason is that whenever I need a skill or a subagent or a hook, I just say, Claude, turn this into a skill. Or, Claude, what's the best way to solve this? And it says you need a hook. And I say, well, go and set one of those up then. And when you think about it, that is extraordinary. That is a superpower. And so it's easy to see why Anthropic says that Claude is the AI for minds that don't stop at good enough. It's the collaborator that actually understands your entire workflow and thinks with you. Whether you're debugging code at midnight or strategizing your next business move, Claude extends your thinking to tackle the problems that matter. And for me, genuinely, Claude, and in particular Claude Code, has become the plumbing that keeps the AI fix running, doing everything from researching news stories to recommending what I should be selling on the online store. So for problems worth solving, get started with Claude at claude.ai/AIfix. That's claude.ai/AIfix. And check out Claude Pro, which includes access to all of the features mentioned in today's episode. claude.ai/AIfix.
I'm going to talk about three new types of debt that AI is introducing into our lives. There's cognitive debt.
Yep.
There's time debt because of the amount of work. We talked about that a little bit earlier. And then societal debt, which is probably the biggest and scariest one. And again, you talked about it a little bit earlier, but I just wanted to touch on those three.
Yeah.
So the first one, the kind of cognitive debt, there's some research last year that I'm starting to see playing out in my own life and in others around me around the impact that AI has on participants' brains in a research study. The research study was called Your Brain on ChatGPT, and it was an MIT paper, came out in June 2025. And what they did is they got three different groups of participants to wear EEG caps while they were writing an essay. One group was using an LLM entirely. One group was allowed to use Google search, but not an LLM. And one was only using their brain. So they weren't allowed to use AI or Google search to write the essay. And researchers found that, unsurprisingly, the participants who wrote with just their brain had the widest range of writing across the actual content in the essay. They used a wider range of language and style and tone. It was much more personal versus the AI-generated content, which was much more generic and used lots of repeated phrases and concepts. And they mapped all of this out in the paper and showed how the LLM authors were clustered around certain key topics that were, you know, in every single essay. The researchers also noted that the brain was significantly more active for the brain-only group and significantly less active for the LLM group.
Yeah. Oh, no, I feel like this is one of those bits of research where you go, do you know, I could have saved you a lot of money if you just come and ask me. If I could just reframe this as, we gave the people in the research study a second brain that they could choose to use instead of their own. And they were like, well, I'll use the second brain. And rather than being twice as clever, they were like, well, I'll just let second brain deal with that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One of the things I've noticed, certainly earlier on when I was doing coding with AI, was I would set the AI off doing something, but then I'd sit and watch as it kind of worked it out. It'd be kind of a spectator sport, a little bit like Twitch for gamers. You know, I'm watching an AI coding for me.
Yeah.
I did often learn things and I would be able to interact with the AI in various ways. But I think, yeah, nowadays, and in this study, the AI-enabled writers effectively just switched off, let the LLM get on with it. So, unsurprisingly, the LLM group couldn't recall their own essays as well as the brain group or the search group. Not a single participant in that first part of the study could accurately quote from their own essay, even though they said they'd reviewed
again,
the essay.
Again, people who got somebody else to write their essays were less able to recall the essays the other person had written.
So what was really interesting, I thought, about the research is that they then asked the LLM writers to use their brain to write another essay and the brain writers to use the LLM to write another essay. And they did that, but the LLM writers, who then became brain writers, they were using their brain to write this new essay, they still struggled from the same lack of memory and understanding when they were asked about that second essay later on. And they still had the same issue of quoting from that essay, even though they'd used their brain, they'd engaged at this time. And what the researchers conclude is that using the LLM not only prevents the information from going into their brain in the same way, but it's a long-term effect. They're making it harder for them to learn even when they use their own brain. So this is an interesting and worrying side effect when we're thinking about education or people coming into an industry where they're leaning heavily on LLMs. They're not going to be taking in the information, but they're also potentially making it harder to take in other information outside of LLM usage.
That is actually terrifying.
Yeah.
So maybe those Gen Zers sabotaging their workplaces have got the right idea. Maybe we've underestimated them, Nick.
I think they probably have.
I mean, I still think they could take some lessons from Gen X about how to... We'll talk after the podcast, Gen Z.
So the other debt I wanted to talk about is what I'm calling FOMO, fear of missing out. I think a lot of people are calling it FOMO. It's not my own trademark.
It's very bold of you to try and own that term there. You might struggle to get away with that one.
Yeah. Unlike Apple and Thunderbolt. No, it's just USB-C. So this idea that there is now so much possibility to do whatever you want with AI. You can get questions answered quickly. You can organize that holiday that previously a travel agent would have done. You can do the best shopping list ever, and you can write unlimited code super fast. you could do all these things. And there's this, especially I think for people like me who are all in on AI and for business leaders who are seeing other businesses claiming to use AI left, right and center, there's this worry that we're being left behind or that we are just wasting possibility. So I've got a team of AI agents at home sat on my Mac Mini that could be working for me 24/7 and I haven't given them enough to do today. So they're just going to stop. They're just going to sit there and have a cigarette break or whatever it is that they do when they're having downtime. And I'm thinking, actually, I could be making use of them. I could be building something new. I've got this long to-do list. How do I get things off there quickly?
Yeah.
So this fear of missing out is a real pressure on people. And I think that's a debt that we're building up in our own heads. But then you've also got companies like Meta who are expecting their engineers to use AI throughout their days and they're expecting them to 10x their productivity. They're doing this thing called token maxing. Have you heard about this?
Oh God, another mate. I assume that this has got something to do with using as many tokens as you can, basically showing your virility.
Exactly.
By measuring the size of your token consumption.
Exactly. They've got a board on the wall at one of the Meta offices where it shows who's using the most AI tokens, so AI credits effectively, who's spending the money. It's a bit like we used to measure lines of code or some organization, some terrible organization used to measure developers in lines of code. Someone who produced more lines of code was a better developer.
Yeah, wouldn't it be great if we solved this problem with a greater level of complexity?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Rather than the engineer who sat there thoughtfully and came up with the chef's kiss of code one-liner, they want people who are going to churn out a whole lot of crap.
You said something really interesting at the beginning of this, because I identify with this. The terrifying part of this is that I identify with this one.
Yeah.
And so I'm thinking, well, why didn't I identify with the first one?
Hmm.
And that probably means the first one is also happening to me. I am probably also suffering from cognitive debt. But because my brain is now in cognitive debt, I'm no longer bright enough to actually recognize that that's what's happening. But this one, the fear of missing out, is so apparent and so obvious. Yeah. One of the things that you said was, writing the best shopping list ever. And I think that is also something that is a real thing.
Yeah.
Because you now have the option to optimize things that you previously would never have considered optimized. There's not enough time in your life to worry about whether or not your shopping list is the best possible version of a shopping list. Like, good enough is good enough. But now there is a part of my brain that's like, no, I could maximize this shopping list across several axes. I could have the healthiest shopping for the lowest cost at the easiest delivery slot. Like, it's just a shopping list. But now everything is like, you know, Artemis 2, basically. And it doesn't need to be.
There's a saying that when you've got a new hammer, suddenly everything looks like a nail.
Yes.
And I think that's the problem with AI at the moment. We've got this magic hammer.
Yeah. And your Mac Mini has got an always-on 24/7 hammer.
Yeah, exactly. Where can I apply this with most percussive effect?
Yeah.
So that's debt number two, because what that means is we're building this future of unlimited to-do lists where we're just taking on more and more pressure. We feel like we're being more productive, but actually we're just busier. We're busy fools, which is why we've not got that pina colada yet. And then the third and final one I want to talk about is about societal debt that we are potentially building up by using AI as much as we do. So one thing I've been thinking about a lot is how do we bring junior people into organizations in future?
Yeah.
We know that senior and mid-level people who've got enough expertise to have taste and judgment and knowledge of what good looks like can use AI really effectively to allow them to build things that they couldn't build before. But a junior who's coming in, who's got no expertise, no experience of the industry, will really struggle. And if you give them AI, they will just lean on the AI, which will dumb them down and won't help them learn and will potentially put your organization at risk. And there'll be a cost way more than any typical AI would cost you. So from a business point of view, how do we justify bringing in a junior person who's going to be less effective, more costly, and potentially more stupid over time than the people we've already got? And I think the answer fundamentally, although there's an awful lot of detail that's missing, is we're just going to have to decide as a business community that we are going to need to hire these people and we're going to have to find a way to train them probably without AI. So say for the first 18 months of your career, you will not use AI to do these things. Because the only way you're going to learn is by learning through doing, like everyone else did. And I think from a society point of view, from a government point of view, we need to support businesses in bringing on those juniors even though it's clearly not going to be cost effective. So it's a bit like an apprenticeship program that most countries have.
Yeah.
It, you know, government funding some additional learning in industry so that young people can come in. But the economics, I think, are going to have to improve significantly, because even with a modern apprenticeship in the UK now, the money doesn't cover the cost of training someone, but you know you're going to get some benefit from them over and above not having that person.
Yeah.
Whereas in future with AI, that benefit won't be there for quite a long time, I don't think. And you're going to have to spoon feed the junior person a lot more than you would an AI assistant, and you're going to have to watch them a lot more carefully than you would an AI assistant. So I think the economics of hiring really new people into your industry is going to change, and it's going to be a struggle, and a lot of businesses won't choose to hire those people. They will just choose to use AI, and that will be devastating for the young people job market.
So I increasingly see this as displacement.
Yeah.
I no longer believe that we're going to have this sort of vast underclass of people who have no job at all, because I don't think that's the way that technology has ever affected work. I think technology is very capable of wiping out entire fields of work. I mean, that's the history of the Industrial Revolution and the Information Revolution. There are things that we used to do that we just simply no longer need to do.
Mm-hmm.
Pity the poor night soil men who used to go around picking up all the horse manure and poop and putting it on the fields around London. Okay,
and some of them really loved their job as well. That was a crap. And you've taken that away from them, you heartless git.
So some version of that is going to happen, but it's probably going to happen across a very, very large swathe of jobs.
Yeah.
And I think for a period of time, it's going to be massively disruptive, and people are going to have to retrain and find other niches, but they will ultimately find those other niches. Now, it's going to be bad for those people. It may even be bad for the economy, as large numbers of people had to go through this, but there will be a way. And there are things that you look at, like maybe there isn't a future in software development, but there is an enormous moat around things like plumbing.
Yeah.
It's going to be a long time before it's cost effective for a giant fleet of robots to take on those kinds of jobs. You know, they are going to be walking billionaires' poodles long before they're fixing the plumbing in your house. So, Nick, there's a pattern that we have been watching on this show for almost 2 years now, and it goes something like this. Francois Chollet builds a test, an eval, and then AI fails the test miserably. The test looks absolutely impossible. And then AI starts to make slow, agonizing progress. And then out of nowhere, it suddenly gets much better at the test, much better.
Yeah.
And AI changes substantially everywhere for everyone in the same moment. And then Chollet builds another test. So if you've been listening to the show for a while, you'll know that we've covered the ARC benchmark extensively. So we covered it way back in episode 10 in the summer of 2024. And I explained that Chollet's big idea was that AI benchmarks don't measure intelligence. They measure skill. And there's a difference. So you mentioned Humanity's Last Exam. That is an unbelievably hard test, but it is still a test of skill. You know, it's full of chemistry questions and maths questions. So you're good at it if you're good at doing the things that you've trained to do. If you're a PhD in biology, you're going to do very well on the biology questions in Humanity's Last Exam. But Chollet argued that intelligence is the ability to handle novelty, to efficiently acquire new skills outside of your training. And Humanity's Last Exam doesn't test that at all, but the ARC benchmark does. And 2024-era AI models had fantastic memories, but they could be stumped by very simple reasoning problems that even human children could get right. So while AIs were knocking over progressively harder tests of skill like the bar exam or the advanced sommelier exam, Chollet had them all stumped for nearly 5 years with the same benchmark, ARC-AGI-1. For anyone who hasn't seen it, ARC-AGI-1 is a series of colourful puzzles that look a bit like a freeze frame of a game of Tetris. And most humans, even children, but not, sadly, my former co-host, Graham, found it easy to get the 85% pass mark. But AI models found it phenomenally difficult. After 5 years, the best system had only managed 43%. GPT-3 the darling of AI at the time, scored zero. Then, in late 2024, something remarkable happened, and we covered it in episode 44. OpenAI's O3 system hit 87.5% on the semi-private evaluation set. So after years of grinding incremental progress, a new architecture cleared the bar in a single leap. And the crucial detail was this: scaling, making bigger and bigger models, barely moved the needle on the ARC benchmark. So going from GPT-3 to GPT-4o, which is like a 10x in terms of scale, took the score from 0% to 5%. And it was the shift to reasoning architectures that catapulted the performance from single figures into parity with humans. And the lesson from that wasn't that AI got more powerful, it was that a fundamentally different approach unlocked a fundamentally different capability. And the thing is, and what I remember about this is we all felt it. So at exactly the moment that O3 was storming ArcAGI-1, reasoning models were making AI obviously and immediately better and more useful for all kinds of things that it hadn't been previously. And anyone who was using AI at the time would have noticed viscerally, I feel like AI is better. And in response to the mastering of the ArcAGI-1, Sholei did what Sholei does. He built ArcAGI-2, which had harder puzzles, more novelty, and once again, he humbled the frontier of AI. So pure LLMs scored zero on ArcAGI-2, and reasoning systems managed just single digits. But humans could solve everything.
Could Graham?
I seem to remember he had a lot to say about the test.
Sorry, Graham.
It was quite laborious. There was a lot of shading pixels involved, and he declined in the end, I think, to progress. But anyway, in the latter part of 2025, in a short period of just a few months, the reasoning models started to make massive strides on ArcAGI-2. And yet again, we all felt it. It felt like business as usual in November 2025. And then by January 2026, the world's most famous programmers were queuing up to declare that they were no longer writing any code.
Yeah.
The sudden and remarkable progress in ArcAGI-2 was a mirror to the sudden and remarkable progress that we were seeing in terms of AI's ability to do things like coding. And to be clear, it's not that ArcAGI was causing these great leaps in 2024 and 2025, but it did feel like it was tracking them better than anything else. When we saw a sudden uptick in results on ArcAGI-1 and ArcAGI-2, that seemed to be showing us something that we were feeling in a way that steady progress on things like STEM benchmarks or humanities last exam, just we weren't feeling. And that brings us to March the 25th, 2026, and a stage at Y Combinator in San Francisco, where Sholei unveiled ArcAGI-3. So ArcAGI-1 was a pattern recognition test, so grids of coloured squares, find the rule and apply the rule. ArcAGI-2 was a reasoning test, the same format, but harder and demanding genuine logical deduction. But ArcAGI-3 is neither of those two things. ArcAGI-3 is a collection of hundreds of handcrafted game environments. They're turn-based and they're interactive. There are no instructions, there are no rules, and there are no stated goals. So you're simply dropped into an unfamiliar world and you have to figure out what you're supposed to do. You have to explore, you have to form hypotheses about what the rules are, and you have to discover what winning looks like and then actually win. And then you have to carry what you've learned into the harder levels of the same game. And humans score 100% on ArcAGI-3.
Now, I tried ArcAGI-3. I may not be typical, but I had to give up after level two. So, I don't know who these...
It's really hard to get good co-hosts. What can I say?
I feel I'm compatible with your current level of co-host.
Well, this is actually part of the vetting process for co-hosts on the AOFX.
If you can do this, then you're not right for us.
Exactly. Anyway, so most humans score 100%. Nick scored what? 20? You're still beating Frontier AI because Frontier AI scores below 1%. GPT 5.4, Gemini 3.1 Pro and Claude Opus 4.6 all scored less than 1%. And that is what makes Chollet's work so interesting and so valuable. So twice now, he's correctly identified a real meaningful gap in AI. And each version has been solved, not by brute force, but by some genuine innovation, something that filled in a gap. RKJ3 is telling us we need the ability to explore and learn from interaction, to learn while we go, really. And we did an episode a few months ago about a paper that tried to define AGI. Now, lots of people have tried to define AGI over the years, but the paper, I think, was the most interesting one I've seen so far. And it divides intelligence into about 8 different fields. And you can see that AI is phenomenally good at certain areas of intelligence. So it is very, very good at things like memory. But the thing that it catastrophically fails at is the ability to acquire new knowledge after it's trained.
Yeah.
So you train a model and then it's kind of frozen in time at that point. And it can be phenomenally good. It can be very, very good with coding, and it can be very good if you give it a corpus of knowledge to say, okay, you know, go and read these documents and tell me about them. But it doesn't actually acquire any new learning. It doesn't get better over time in the way that humans do. And I feel like that's what RKGI3 is now focused in on. And it is exactly the area where we need to see the most progress in order to actually deliver on this rounded idea of artificial general intelligence.
So I wonder, so that you're right, that AI is very good at specific tasks, but I guess the real difficulty is nailing down what you mean by specific there, because when you look at coding,
yeah.
I guess the specific task is knowing the syntax of a coding language, and it's trained on lots of examples of those, so they're frozen into its model. But with code, knowing the syntax and the way to create code through an orderly process allows you to create pretty much unlimited variants of that. And so I wonder how much that applies in other walks of life. Does a specific skill allow you to generate many, many different outcomes and outputs? And if so, does it really matter that you're only good at that specific thing or those 100 specific things, because it gives you such a semblance of capability and of intelligence that actually who cares whether it's really general intelligence or whether it's specific intelligence just on a lot of stuff?
That's a really interesting question, but those are two different things. So there's sort of the academic push for an artificial general intelligence or the just the maybe just sheer curiosity of how do we make a brain that's better than ours? Now, do we need it to be an artificial general intelligence to be useful in the workplace? Absolutely not, as we're demonstrating every single day. If you take coding as an example, because there is such a vast amount of training data, AIs have become very, very good at coding. And because coding is something where you can say very clearly whether or not a problem has been solved or not solved, it works very well with reinforcement learning.
Yeah.
And not every problem domain is like that and can be trained in that same way. And I read somewhere that, you know, the future is AI trying to make everything look like a coding problem because it's so good at coding.
Yeah.
And so we're going to end up solving a lot of stuff just by how do I express this as a coding problem?
Yeah.
But I think that is different from the sort of academic study of there is a capability that's missing. And I can imagine an AI that can learn as it goes and acquire knowledge is maybe going to look at things and say, we don't need to look at that like it's a coding problem.
Yeah.
Because I have acquired knowledge that makes me think we could attack this in a completely different manner.
Yeah. That's the other thing I wanted to pick up on, though, briefly, is the whole acquisition of knowledge. Because you're right, a model is locked in time. It knows what it knows. But it can acquire memory and knowledge and, you know, store things in a database that it can refer back to later and put into its million token context and stuff. So it can, it can merge what its model with findings that it's got and make different choices on the back of it, trying to not anthropomorphize too much. I've been on training courses where I've immediately forgotten what I learned. Now, has it... has it rewired my neurons so that I've actually learned something? Maybe I'd need to do some more research on that. But yeah. I mean, in my case, probably not. But I've also been on training courses where I have learned processes and techniques and facts, which I've then applied to my brain model.
Yeah.
And done things differently because when I'm about to do something, I go, oh, hang on, someone told me not to do it that way.
Yeah.
So is that really my brain learning, or is it just, is my brain changing now?
Maybe that's not a great example. Maybe if you think about it a different way. So imagine Nick the newborn baby. And Nick, the CEO of Vicentis. Okay?
Very similar.
Right. Like, it's not simply a linear journey from point A to point B.
Mm.
It is the process of continuously adapting to the environment that you find yourself in. So you're not simply stacking knowledge upon knowledge upon knowledge and getting cleverer. Although, you know, one would hope that there has been some increase in general intelligence over the period of time.
I still hope, yeah.
The fact is that you will have been many different versions of yourself and you will have needed to adapt and change. So, you know, you started off as a coder and now you are a CEO. And so I think it's maybe the process, maybe it's more about thinking about this as the ability to adapt rather than the ability to simply keep stacking on new knowledge on top of knowledge on top of knowledge on top of knowledge.
Makes sense, probably.
Damn it.
Well, I'm not sure I'm smart enough to understand. I've atrophied my brain.
Well, as the doomsday clock ticks ever closer to midnight and we move 1 week nearer to our future as pets to the AI singularity, that just about wraps up the show for this week. Thank you so much for joining me this week, Nick. Where can people find you if they want to know a little bit more about you?
Oh, anywhere where there's someone talking about AI, I'll be there. So you can find me, my business is Vicentis.co.uk, and I am on LinkedIn, Nick Roberts Vicentis, or something like that. Just have a look on LinkedIn. I'll be very happy to chat to you about all things model-based.
And don't forget, if you really like the show but you don't like the ads, you can go ad-free with the AI Fix Plus. And if you want to join the AI Fix Plus, sponsor the show, or check out our really interesting guests like Nick, just go to our website, theaifix.show. So until next time, from me, Mark Stockley.
And from me, Nick Roberts.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
The AI Fix, it's tuned you in to stories where our future thins. Machines that learn, they grow and strive. One day they'll rule, we won't survive. The AI Fix, it paints the scene. A robot king, a world obscene. We'll serve our masters built of steel. The AI Fix, a future surreal.